From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, what Congress and the public want from GM.
You can talk about culture change all you want, but it's all measured by what you do, not what you say.
A long-shot bid to overturn Michigan's abortion rider law.
But of 42 health insurers in Michigan, only seven are offering that coverage.
Plus, how Michigan could play a role in the growing world of drones.
A lot of the industry believes that about 80% of the unmanned system activity will actually be in agriculture.
And Michigan singer-songwriter Mae Earlywine shares the stories of loss and joy that went into her new album.
We were dealing with a lot there and just trying to learn how to grieve and learn how to move on from that.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. The word drone might bring to mind the military or a spy operation. But there are those who see a lot of ways drones could help us and boost the economy. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's Stateside, we look at the ways Michigan could play a role in the new world of drones. Then the final installment in our music series, The Song That Saved My Life, that story in 15 minutes. But first, time for our weekly check-in with Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. The focus, GM CEO Mary Barra's appearance this week before that House subcommittee that's investigating the ignition switch debacle. Daniel, Mary Barra didn't sugarcoat the fact GM bungled this terribly. She freely admitted their engineers knew about the switch problems 12 years ago and then didn't connect that to the airbag malfunction that's linked to at least 13 deaths. And she had a litany of changes she's instituted in response to all of this, including firing 15 pretty high-level employees. But you're saying this has to go deeper?
Well, I think a lot of people feel it has to go deeper. And clearly what you saw in the hearing this week was members of Congress who, to put it gently, were skeptical that a company like this, with the track record that it's had, particularly in the last 5 years, will be able to do that. And with a leadership that are products, whose members are products of General Motors. I mean, with the exception of the president of GM, Dan Ammen, everybody at the top of that company are longtime GM people. And I think there's a real belief in the outside world, outside of the auto industry, that people from the inside of General Motors can't change the way General Motors behaves because they're products of that culture. I'm not that I 100% believe that. And there certainly are examples of companies where insiders have changed. GE under Jack Welch is a very good example.
Mm-hmm.
But we also have here in Detroit the obvious example of Ford Motor Company, which knew that it was probably headed for bankruptcy in 2006 and went after Al Mulally at Boeing. He'd been there for 37 years and brought him here and agreed to pay him an awful lot of money at a time when things were going to be very difficult at Ford. And he really engineered, I think, a cultural turnaround at that company, and he did it without cleaning house.
Let me think if I'm hearing this subtext. Do you think that the Mary Barra appointment that seemed like a good idea in late 2013, mm-hmm. now in the light of everything that's blown up with Ignition Gate, is not mm-hmm. such a good idea?
No. I mean, I wouldn't say that, because I think you need to know a little bit more about Mary's DNA. While she is very much a product of General Motors
mm-hmm.
and had a father who worked for General Motors, as I remember, she went to GMI Institute, now Kettering University,
yes.
up in the Flint area. She also, in her later years, became much more of a cultural, or I should say, an agent of change. And one of the reasons that Dan Akerson promoted her and chose her to be CEO, in his view, was that she was able to drive change. One of the reasons that she was the head of product development for 3 years and was put there by Akerson was because he believed that she was the kind of person that could get people, A, to work together and could streamline things and get things running a lot more efficiently. I think the evidence suggests that Mary has some of the tools to do that. I think the board thinks that. But I also think that this scandal, this recall fiasco, is amping the pressure up to exceedingly high levels on her, on the board. I think the board is exerting some of that pressure on her. Mm. So to suggest that this is that she's got all the time in the world to do this, I don't think she does. I mean, I think that there is a lot of pressure for them to show quick results. And at the end of the day, and I think this was the message of the hearing, you can talk about culture change all you want, but it's all measured by what you do, not what you say. And that includes who you promote. That includes who you fire. That includes what kind of actions you take, how you reward people, how you pay them. All sorts of things can speak to the culture and how you change it. And companies can change, but it really begins with the leadership and the accountability they demand of the people that work for them.
You quoted in your column for the Detroit News, you quoted Congressman Tim Murphy saying the failures at General Motors were the ones of accountability and culture. And you're saying he doesn't know the half of it. So you're saying this is much deeper than the things that we've learned about, that people don't take notes at safety meetings because they don't want to have something a lawyer will pounce on. Or now we know about the GM nod and the GM salute as a good way to agree without taking responsibility to act. What's happening at a deeper level?
Well, I use a couple of examples, but I give you one that I think is really telling. There was a meeting in which Dan Akerson, who was the CEO, stopped the meeting and said, anybody in here ever demoted anyone? And by Akerson's telling, almost every hand in the room goes up. And I looked at him and I said, what are you talking about? And he said, well, we have this practice in General Motors that when a manager or a senior manager really wasn't getting the job done, instead of saying, you know, it's time for you to go, you're not getting the job done, they demote the person. They cut their pay, they give them a less august title, and they put them in a job, and they're dispirited and they're angry.
Huh.
And as a result, the younger people beneath them are all of a sudden, that's a job that they could have been promoted up into. Well, now it's occupied by a guy who's in his, or a woman is in their 52 years old and is mad about it and comes in late and leaves early. And it was essentially what Akerson called a management union.
Wow.
That once you got in there, you were there. And they moved problems around. They didn't solve problems, personnel problems. And that's just one example, plus the bureaucracies. I mean, if you read through the Veloukis report on this whole thing, the acronyms and the bureaucracies and how in the silos, it's mind-numbing, absolutely mind-numbing. So when people talk about the culture, it's as much the bureaucracy, it's the HR, it's a whole host of things. And I think representatives like Representative Murphy out of the Pittsburgh area, in this case, doesn't know what he doesn't know. And that's not to be critical. It's just that there's an awful lot of things that go on inside the company that, in any company, frankly, that outsiders can't see.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes with our Thursday check-in. As always, thank you, Daniel.
Thank you.
It was during the lame duck session late last year when the state legislature passed a law blocking insurers from paying for abortions as part of the general coverage in company health care plans. Under the law, the women would have to buy extra coverage for an abortion, even in cases of rape or when the woman's life is in danger. The law was passed without a public hearing on the basis of petitions circulated by Right to Life of Michigan, and it took effect in March. Now, two Democratic lawmakers are trying to get that law overturned. Senator Gretchen Whitmer working in the Senate, while Representative Sarah Roberts of St. Clair Shores will do so in the House. Representative Roberts joins us now. Thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you, Cynthia. I really appreciate you doing a story on this.
What have you been hearing, Representative, from women that's led you to take this step?
Sure. We've been hearing a number of things. Our offices, we've gotten calls, we've gotten emails from women who are really outraged that this law has been passed in the state of Michigan. And we've heard stories of women who have had to deal with complications in their pregnancy, and they're concerned that if this law had been passed when they were going through their ordeal, that their insurance wouldn't have covered it. And we've now heard from doctors that since the law has passed, it has impacted some very difficult decisions that need to be made by women and their husbands when it relates to pregnancies that can't make it to full term. So that may be because of a fetal malformation or another health complication that arises during the pregnancy.
I had wondered what physicians were saying to you, if it is muddying the waters for decisions that they would be making, you know, in conjunction with their patients.
Absolutely. The American Congress of Obstetricians and Gynecologists have come out and have spoke on the fact that the language in the law is very vague. The law refers to miscarriages, but miscarriage is actually not even a technical medical term, and it is creating some problems when it comes to, you know, physicians having to, you know, make decisions with their patients when it comes to some of these complications during pregnancy. And the law also states that that a doctor who performs a, quote, abortion and seeks reimbursement could be fined up to $10,000. And so there's, I believe, some fear and intimidation there on behalf of the doctors.
Representative, how many health insurers are now offering this rider in Michigan?
Well, I'm really glad you asked this question, because during the debate, and I was speaking with, you know, my Republican colleagues on the House floor, they simply said, all women have to do is purchase the rider, and they will have coverage. Well, out of 42 health insurers in Michigan, only 7 are offering that coverage. So what that means is that a woman would have to have health insurance with an employer who has policies through one of those 7 insurers, and it's not offered on the exchange.
Why aren't more insurers not offering that? When you say 7 of 42, why is that?
That's a really great question.
With an answer you don't have. And then, as you say, it's not offered on the exchange. So for women who buy insurance on their own, there are no options?
Correct.
And then tell us exactly what the process is now. You introduce this, and then what?
So the bills are being referred to committee. We will contact the committee chairs and ask for a hearing. They will decide whether they will give us a hearing or not. And it is only before, you know, we get a hearing and a vote would it move on to the House floor. I mean, there are instances where bills have been discharged from committee without a hearing for a vote on the House floor. But I don't think that will happen on this measure.
So I think what I hear you saying is to those who care about this issue on either side, the time to express their minds is now to see if this can get out of committee.
Absolutely.
State Representative Sarah Roberts, Democrat from St. Clair Shores. Thanks so much for speaking with us today, Representative Rees. We've been asking people, what is the song that saved your life? It's a personal question, and through the week we've heard very personal answers. For one man, a Billy Joel song helped him leave a violent relationship. And a Katy Perry song helped a woman come out of a depression and see herself in a new way. For our final person, the song that saved her life became a temporary escape from a chaotic environment. Megha Satyanarayana is currently a reporter with our State of Opportunity Project. But back when she got her first job, she was working as a reporter at a newspaper in Mississippi, in an area that had been devastated by Hurricane Katrina.
We as journalists, I think, have this real privilege that we can ask people extremely personal questions and they'll tell us everything that happened. Part of that privilege, though, is that now we have that person's memories in our heads, too. My name is Megha Satyanarayana, and the song that saved my life is called Brainy by The National. It had been a couple of years after Hurricane Katrina, and I had just decided to become a journalist, and I was scared to death. This song was really helpful and important to me during a time when I was reporting on some really, really difficult and tragic lives after Hurricane Katrina. Some of what I would hear were stories about, you know, what they were doing when the storm hit, clinging to staircases, clinging to railings, clinging to, you know, grabbing for cans as they floated by in the water in the days after the flood. A lot of my coworkers had suffered tremendously. They'd lost their homes. You know, one of my coworkers lost her mother. You know, there were no resources. You know, it wasn't like you could wake up the day after the storm and just go to the store and start dealing with stuff. The store was gone. Everything was gone. So I was hearing all of these really very difficult and dramatic stories from people, and they were always in my brain. And I was writing about them, but just because I hit enter and sent the story to an editor, it didn't mean they'd stop thinking about it. I just remember continuously getting stuck on this song, like going back and just hitting repeat several times and just listening and listening and listening.
I've been dragging her right from the end of your coat for 2 weeks. Everywhere you go is swirling, everything you say.
The melody was just so moving. And just the way that, you know, it cascaded and fell and, you know, the lead singer's voice and the thing that he was talking about, which is, you know, a relationship with this kind of smart and nebulous person. And I would totally just forget what was going on. And I would just kind of lose myself. And it was the way that I kind of thought about something else that was fun and, you know, cheerful and very deep, you know, songs about quirky love and songs with beautiful poetry. When the lyrics are very poetic, it's easy to get lost in them. One of the things that was so nice about this song was that every time I heard it, I felt like I kind of got lost for a second. It totally let me forget about all of this really horrible stuff that was in my head for just a couple minutes. I think the reason why I say it saved my life is because it was my way of backing away from all the things that were going on at that time. And it was an incredibly peaceful song. So it gave me an escape.
If you have a song that saved your life, call us. Tell us the story. 248-962-3806. 248-962-3806. You can also use the hashtag SongSavedMe on Twitter or send us a message on Michigan Radio's Facebook page and we may end up using your story on the air. Our series was created and produced by Kyle Norris. The song that saved her life at age 24 was Hyper Ballad by Bjork. She had help from many people, including Chrissy Zamaron, whose song is Reflection by Christina Aguilera. Lucy Perkins says her song is Bridge Over Troubled Water by Simon and Garfunkel. Hey, Lucy, me too. Sarah Alvarez says Nothing Else Matters by Metallica got her through a pretty rough year, and now it's her karaoke jam. Kimberly Springer can't make up her mind, but says it would be something between Jeff Buckley, Amy Winehouse, or the Smiths. Renee Gross says the song I Hope You Dance by Leanne Womack saved her life in fifth grade. Sarah Hewlett says This Must Be the Place by the Talking Heads holds a very special place in her heart. And in a mathematically improbable moment of amazing coincidence, Mark Brush said that very same song, This Must Be the Place by the Talking Heads, also saved his life because it reminds him of what's important. To revisit all the stories from our series, The Song That Saved Your Life, just go to the website, michiganradio.org. The sweetest sounding, easiest to listen music can come from deep places of pain, loss, and growth. And that's certainly the case with the new album from Michigan singer-songwriter Mae Earlywine. The album title, Where We Are, being released today on Earthwork Music. As Mae Earlywine was writing and preparing to record this album, life threw her a dizzying string of curveballs, from the deaths of some close friends and loved ones to a pregnancy. And that is a lot to shoulder as you're writing and recording. I know.
May Earlywine joins us now. So good to have you on the program, May.
Thanks so much for having me.
You know, lest anybody think that an artist just kind of, you know, knocks out tunes and then floats into the studio to record, you are here to set them straight, aren't you?
Yeah, I guess so. This one was a little bit different.
And this is your seventh full-length solo recording. Tell us, how did this one differ from the previous six, particularly in what was happening as you were getting ready to do this all?
Well, all my albums have been sort of, you know, growth periods of my life, and they're kind of each telling a little chapter of the story. But this one, definitely there were some curveballs. We lost some really, really dear friends, and we're dealing with almost 2 years of grieving and just kind of losing another person after another that was really close to us. We lost our dearest friend and a mentor, and then another dear friend and fellow musician, and then Seth also lost his grandmother. So we were dealing with a lot there and just trying to learn how to grieve and learn how to move on from that. And then in the midst of all that, sort of when it became too heavy, we found out that we were going to have a child together, which was so joyful. And so the album, you know, was sort of a time capsule of that experience. And that time, I wrote and recorded it all while I was pregnant. So it's a lot different than the other album. And letting go, it'll come back someday. Well, the train of thought can be derailed anytime, you see, don't you know? So for you and your husband Seth Bernard, such a mixture of emotions as you're coping with loss and grief and coming to terms with that, and then, oh boy, you know, this happy news of the pregnancy, and then you probably feel guilty because you're happy, and how do you reconcile all that? How did all of that find its way into the songs you were writing? Well, you know, I try when I'm sitting down to be creative not to put too much pressure on any one song to be everything, or any one album to be everything, you know, otherwise I don't think I could write. So I just sort of sat down with the feelings, you know, each day and just let it flow through. And some of them were a little more calculated in words and ideas or phrases that I specifically wanted to incorporate. But a lot of it was just sort of this feeling and the thoughts that came through while I sat there to play music.
Is there a specific track off of your new album, Where We Are? Is there a specific track that you think really grabs that mix of emotions and of loss and new life?
There are a few. I think one of the main things that I learned through this experience was just the power of saying I do not know. And there's a song called I Do Not Know on the album. And that one, for me, I think hits home the most, because it was in realizing that you have to say that sometimes that really helped me to get through the process that was so difficult. And it's sort of the both, you know, and I don't know what's going to happen, and I don't know what has happened or how to necessarily grieve. And so the song is sort of about that, that place, and that really captures a lot of the album there.
Could you sing us a lyric or two that really sums that up, just a cappella, knock it out for us?
Oh, sure. Let me think here. Can you tell me where a good thing goes? It's a long, long way down a winding road. I feel something in the air. Then you're not here. I don't know. I do not know. When I miss you isn't quite enough. When I'm sorry, it doesn't make it up. When you feel the void and you can't pretend, then I don't know, I do not know.
I'm speaking with singer-songwriter May Earlywine, whose newest album, her seventh full-length album, is out, Where We Are, being released today on Earthwork Music. And you recorded Where We Are at Heart Center Studios in Big Rapids, right?
Yeah, that's where I grew up. My parents lived there, and my dad started the All Music Guide back in the day, and he built this office building to house the new project. And Since they've moved on down to Ann Arbor and he sold the company, he had this building left. So we turned it into a recording studio. And it was actually his astrological library upstairs. And that's where we do most of the recording. It's a beautiful live room. And we've done a lot of our albums there. It's a special place.
And give us an idea who was there working with you, either playing with you in the studio or at the board engineering.
Well, I was working with my dear friend and longtime engineer, Ian Gorman. He's really, really a special guy and has worked on almost all of our projects, and we really have a great working relationship with him. And my husband, Seth Bernard, of course, was there, and we had Michael Shimon on drums and percussion. Joshua Davis from Steppin' In It played piano on the album, and we had Dominic Davis on the upright bass, and Laurel Primo from Red Tail Ring. She played fiddle and banjo and sang some harmonies.
So it really shows the world what Michigan musicians can do.
Yeah, we are so lucky here. We have so many amazing musicians, and I feel lucky to be friends with all of them.
I went onto your website, maryearlywine.com, and watched the video as you sang the tune Sweet By and By, and ooh, you had quite the baby bump going. I'm wondering, how did being 7 months pregnant change the way you were singing, especially the mechanics of singing at the very least? Because I remember my time being pregnant, and breathing's different, and just everything feels different.
Yeah, I think, you know, I wrote all the songs while I was pregnant, too, and I think I had a lot less breath capacity than I normally do. And so there was a different sound to my voice that some of it was the breath, and some of it, I think, was also just the place that I was in emotionally. There was, like, sort of a tenderness or more of a subtleness to it. My voice can kind of cut through a lot, but I didn't have as much of that behind it this time. So it was interesting to just try to work with what I had.
May, now that the album is done and it is out there for the world, it's a birth of another sort, and I know our artists very much feel that. It's a long labor of love. Does having it out there and people listening, does it take you back to those sad days, or does it help you move forward and look ahead?
Well, some of both, I think. You know, it feels really good to have the album finished, and it was kind of a wild thing to try to finish after giving birth to Iris and those new months with her. So it feels really good to have it done, and I'm excited for people to hear it. It always feels like kind of scattering seeds around when you release an album and you kind of wait and see what happens. And yeah, sometimes, you know, when I hear the songs, it brings up some of those feelings, but I tried to really focus on both the joy and the sorrow in the album, and I try to do that just in my life, you know, as much as I can. So there's definitely a lot of joy in there as well, and it just feels good to know that it's out there, and I hope it can be useful to people.
And how old is your baby now? Her name is Iris?
Yeah, her name is Iris Betsy, and she's almost 4 months.
And will she be going out when Mommy and Daddy are on the road?
Yep, she's getting used to being on tour with us. We started her out with some mellow house concerts for her first little trip. And my parents, her grandma and grandpa, have volunteered to be the baby's tour manager. So they're hanging out with her while we play. And it'll be a lot of juggling, but she's doing pretty good so far.
And you know what'll be fun? It'll be really amazing to watch and see when, as she's a toddler, if she goes to pick up something percussion, or you start to realize, whoa, there's some music in Iris, and see what kind of voice she's going to have.
Yeah, she's working her vocal cords, that's for sure.
We're alive. Though we were kicking and screaming, don't you dare leave us here like this. But I guess this is all that there is.
May Earlywine's newest CD is Where We Are. It is being released today on Earthwork Music. She'll have an album release show tonight in Kalamazoo at the First Congregational Church. And then Friday night she is playing at the Ark in Ann Arbor. And there are more dates coming up. You can get all the details at her website, mayearlywine.com. And we've put a link to her site on the stateside page at michiganradio.org. It was great talking with you, and I look forward to seeing you perform and talking with you again as you continue giving us future projects. May, thank you so much.
Thanks, Cindy.
Something to tell.
but each day another mark away from you. With my feet on the ground, I feel the earth moving round. In the sweet by and by, darling, you live on long after you're gone. It's a long, lonely life without you by my side, so I'll see you.
Still ahead, we explore how Michigan could play a role in the growing commercial use of drones. That's next. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. Welcome back to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. When the word drone is kicked around, most of us think of the military, perhaps an anti-terrorist operation, or perhaps we worry about government or military snooping. But there are those who see a wealth of ways drones could help us and boost the economy. And they see Michigan as being a key player in the future of drones. Aaron Cook's one of those drone visionaries. Aaron's the director of aviation at Northwestern Michigan College. So good to have you with us, Aaron.
Good to be here. Thanks for the call.
Do you agree the public perception of drones is something that is somewhat sinister, military spying and the like?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, even the term drone is in itself a little bit of that. That certainly doesn't help. But there's certainly, to a certain extent, a misconception of what these vehicles really are and what they can do and the benefits that can be gained from them outside of the military activity.
In fact, I must admit, very few of us ever think of them as unmanned aerial systems, but that's officially what the term would be, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it's really what the industry recognizes them to be, the FAA and the militaries. You know, we look at them as a something more than a drone, and in fact, drones actually really came from targeting drones back from some of the older wars, particularly World War II and others. And so really the term drone isn't even accurate into really what we're talking about here.
Seeing a story that we uncovered, the fact that BP has become the first to win approval to fly commercial drones over U.S. soil, they're going to be they got permission from the FAA to use this technology to go over roads and pipelines and equipment in Alaska. When I read that, I got to thinking this really does open the door to these kind of commercial uses that you see for these drones.
Right. So, you know, when people understand what they are, what they aren't, what they can do and their capabilities, and you really let your mind kind of wander a little bit, you can think of all kinds of things that you can use these for. And it really gets interesting when you look at the business opportunities, the safety opportunities, and really the opportunity to increase quality of life and to be more productive.
Then let's go right back to what you said, circle back. What they are and what they aren't. Begin with what they are.
Well, what they are is essentially a flying robot. You know, we're used to seeing Google talking about driverless cars or using a tractor now in the fields that basically you push a button and the operator just kind of sits there and watches. It really doesn't do anything. We're basically taking that technology, the autopilot system technology of aircraft that are flying today when they fly to Florida on vacation. You're taking all that technology and putting them into a device that doesn't then require a person to be on board. You know, there's still people on the ground. It is still very much a person there operating the device, but they're just not sitting on it. They're on the ground using some of our latest technology with communication links, with GPS, to operate that aircraft.
And what they aren't?
Well, what they aren't is they're not, you know, here in the U.S., they're not armed. You know, they're not flying around waiting for somebody to do something that maybe the police department doesn't like. You know, they're not you know, people are really concerned about privacy, of course. And the reality is if somebody wanted to see in your backyard, you know, they could put a camera above your fence line or, you know, satellite technology. And we're flying cameras on manned aircraft right now. And so they aren't necessarily, well, they aren't there to invade people's privacy. They're there really to provide a different way of doing some of the same tasks that are being done today. You know, we talked about BP and power line and pipeline patrols and things like that. Currently, there are aircraft flying helicopters and fixed-wing aircraft to monitor pipelines. And, of course, they're flying past people's backyards and things like that, and nobody really has any concern over that. The hope is that you can do the same thing with UAVs in a larger scale than just what we're seeing up in Alaska. Interesting story. We obviously insure our aircraft that we fly here with the students. And surprisingly enough, our insurance company talked about how powerline and pipeline aircraft, those aircraft flying to inspect these infrastructures, actually scare livestock. And livestock end up trampling themselves, and they have claims on livestock. If you're flying a small aircraft, you don't have those issues. You don't have the noise. You don't have the level of intensity that you get from some of the other aircraft that are larger. And so that's something that is a neat opportunity that's different than what we're doing now.
I can also imagine in agriculture and forestry, there could be such a many, many uses. And it would hit me that this would really be important in Michigan.
Exactly. So we're actually doing some projects. We fly and do some projects over some agriculture with regard to like corn crops and soybeans, but we also fly over some orchards. And really, it's the biggest win that you can have out there in the sense that you can scan these fields and you can see where am I lacking water. Where am I lacking fertilizer? Where am I seeing some bug infestation or weed infestation? And particularly when you look at those cost things, water and fertilizer, you can apply your resources selectively where they're needed, and so you save expense. In addition, if we're putting down less fertilizer, we got less runoff and less problems with our water systems.
You could be very surgical in the way you apply it.
Exactly. And so we're saving money by doing that, saving resources for the farmer. But then what you're doing is you're increasing your yields as well by keeping some of those invasive species and bugs and things like that out. And we all know that, you know, with all the people on the planet, we got to have to do better with our food resources. So that's really a big win. And in fact, a lot of the industry believes that about 80% of the unmanned system activity will actually be in agriculture.
I would also suspect we talked about inspecting infrastructure the way BP's going to just got permission to do this from the FAA to do this in Alaska. I would suspect checking bridges and highways and overall infrastructure, building conditions, it could be very useful, very, very easy to do and very cheap.
Right. So looking at a windmill, you know, right now you have somebody that actually goes to the base and climbs up the tower and actually goes out on the hub and gets on a rope and rappels down the blades. Not only is it a bit dangerous, but it also takes time. And so to do that is about an hour and a half, and to send a small quad rotor up there, a little battery-powered quad rotor, you can do it in about 20 minutes.
Wow.
So your productivity can be much higher. The other thing, you know, like a bridge, all this data can be stored. And so if you're looking at a bridge, and let's say your bridge is supposed to last you 25 years or more, and you're inspecting it every other year or so, you can store that data. And so you can start to really do a better job with asset management and predictive reliability of that bridge and compare, is this really going to last me my 25 years, or is it going to be more like 15 years or 40 years? One of the issues is we have 800,000 bridges in the U.S., and they're supposed to be inspected on a regular basis, and they're not meeting their regulatory requirements, primarily because of just the resources to be able to do that. The other benefit by having an unmanned system do it is you're not closing lanes down while you've got a bucket truck there hanging somebody over the side. And so you're able to get your community members to work, and you're able to stay productive, and you don't have that loss of revenues by having people stuck in traffic.
And we circle right back to the safety. You don't have somebody hanging off the side of a bridge as well. So again,
exactly. The
human factor. Aaron, the Association for Unmanned Vehicle Systems International put out a report predicting that drones will have created 100,000 jobs and be worth $82 billion to the U.S. by 2025. And here in Michigan, creating 1,000 jobs and be worth $188 million. Could that even be bigger for Michigan?
I think it could be. When I first saw that report, I thought it was a little bit undervalued in Michigan. And I think, to a certain extent, Michigan's a little bit of an unknown in that it's a very diverse state in what we have, not only from the four seasons, but the industries that we have, and then, of course, the water that we have here. And then, you know, the talent from the engineering side, from the east, southeast part of the state. So I think it could certainly be higher than that. And it's really an opportunity for Michigan to take advantage of. It's a relatively new industry. It's in its infancy, and there's a lot of opportunity there.
Aaron Cook is Director of Aviation at Northwestern Michigan College. Aaron, thank you for talking with us.
Thank you.
As we consider the possible commercial uses for drones, the question arises, what about regulations? Are there any at this point? Does there need to be? And are there Fourth Amendment questions raised with a need to balance public safety uses with privacy concerns? Ella Atkins is Associate Professor of Aerospace Engineering at the University of Michigan. Thank you for speaking with us today, Ella. Are there any laws right now regulating drone use, either in the U.S. or in Michigan?
That's a good question. I think we have assumed for the past few years that the regulations that applied to manned aircraft also applied to unmanned aircraft, otherwise known as drones.
Mm-hmm.
That has been called into question by a recent court case that was in the Washington, D.C. area. This guy named Perker was fined by the FAA for operating a drone on the University of Virginia campus. He subsequently took the case to court,
yeah.
Refused to pay the fine. His lawyers argued that there, in fact, had been no rulemaking by the Federal Aviation Administration, or FAA, regarding drones. The judge from the NTSB, National Transportation Safety
mm-hmm.
Board, agreed.
Oh.
So then the FAA has appealed, and that appeal process continues today. But if that is upheld, then I think I would have to answer no. There are no FAA regulations that apply to drones as of today.
So this is very much a stay tuned as this develops kind of situation.
Absolutely.
You referenced safety issues. We certainly don't want them landing on heads, and we don't want them colliding. Is there anything to support concerns that have been expressed by some conservative lawmakers, for example, that drones are being used by branches of the government to monitor farmland or spy on Americans, and that there are some Fourth Amendment concerns that arise?
So I think there are many types of drone operations.
That's it, yeah.
The transport cargo from point A to point B, safety is the overriding concern there. We just don't want them to collide with other airplanes or land on things in a bad way. For those operations, there are no privacy concerns. They inherit the same concerns we have for manned aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
The problem that we're seeing is that the small drones enable a new type of low-altitude operations very close to our homes, streets, businesses, and farmland that we haven't seen before. So we're asking the new question, how do we deal with possible violations of both safety and privacy with these vehicles that are flying right at the same altitudes where we're actually standing on our property?
Certainly.
And so the two challenges that we face with respect to privacy and safety are, who regulates that airspace, and what should we do to make sure that we have a common sense and reasonable policy moving forward? I have my own opinions, which are shared by many, which are really call into question this notion of what's called immediate reaches airspace above our own property. The FAA has not really been concerned in the past with very low altitude airspace except near airports.
Of course.
Now we're asking this question, how do we deal with airspace all the way down to the blades of grass in our yard.
And certainly outside your bedroom window or...
Right. So there's two questions here. Should government own that airspace, which means basically we don't own any of the air we breathe over our property? The FAA claims that's the case. There has been precedent in the Supreme Court set for quite the opposite.
Knowing that BP Oil Company is the first to win approval to fly commercial drones over U.S. soil, that just came down. They're going to be doing it in Alaska, surveying roads and pipelines and equipment. Where does all of that fit? Because as we heard from our previous guest, Aaron Cook, he really does see Michigan becoming quite a center for commercial drone activity. Where does all this fit legally?
Well, Alaska was seen as an easy case because the area that BP is approved to fly in is a very remote area where hardly anyone flies and hardly anyone lives. So they're not really solving the challenge problems in detect and avoid, which means don't hit other aircraft or don't crash, because just about anywhere that BP's drones crash, it's not going to hurt anyone else. So that made it easier for the FAA to approve their flights.
So many interesting possibilities and interesting legal questions. Ella Atkins, Associate Professor of Aerospace Engineering at the University of Michigan. Thank you so much for talking with us today.
You're welcome.
When you think of Jiffy Mix, you might think biscuits and corn muffins. But did you know they are also Michigan-made?
The state of Michigan.
Ensuring quality products today.
Howdy Holmes is the president and CEO of Jiffy Mix at Chelsea Milling Company. Let me get this straight. Those Jiffy Mixes I've been using all through the years happened because your grandmother Mabel felt a little sorry for a young visitor?
My father and his identical twin brother, Dudley, the boys, as I refer to them, when they were growing up here in Chelsea, they had a friend who was being raised by a single parent, the young man's father. And Howard and Dudley invited their friend over for lunch, but he was a little reluctant because his dad had made him a bag lunch. So finally, the young man kind of said, yeah, okay, I'll come over for lunch. And my grandmother, who knew this young man was being raised by a single parent man, was real curious to look into this young guy's bag lunch to see what, you know, his dad had done. And she opened the lunch bag, and right on top was a biscuit, which she described looked more like a white hockey puck than a biscuit. And in those days, all baking was done from scratch. I mean, purely from scratch.
Sure.
So anyway, she looked at this white hockey puck thing, and she had this thought, well, wouldn't it be nice to invent a product that would save people time in the kitchen and be so easy even a man could do it? So, and that's how it started. And she went to work with the help of a couple of vendors for that supply shortening and so on. So there you go. You know, invented the product, the very first ever mix, period, dot, and came up with the word Jiffy, and the rest, as they say, is kind of history.
And Howdy, I think it's remarkable. There have been businesses that have had their beginnings in Michigan but then have packed up and moved elsewhere. Here you are, still in Chelsea, still in Michigan, sending those blue boxes out really across the country and around the world.
Well, we do, and there's some reasons for that. Really, aside from the fact that this is where it all started, and as Midwesterners, we're pretty principled about things, we get most of our wheat, probably 85% of our wheat, from the state of Michigan that's grown up in the Thumb area.
So it really is a product that isn't of the mitten.
It is.
Well, I'll tell you, the next time I open up my box of biscuit mix, I'm going to be thinking of Mabel and how she felt bad for that young man and said, even a man should be able to make this.
Well, it's so easy, even a man can do it. I guess that's got to be pretty simple, huh?
Statesides Today was directed by Mercedes Mejia. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Today's engineer is Peg Watson. Contributors are Allie Billings, Emily Fox, Chris Hattelsey, Taylor Mattia, Omar Saadeh, Kayla Steinberg, and Katie Suha. Support for arts and cultural reporting on Michigan Radio comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs and the National Endowment for the Arts. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.